Welcome back to the Paradigm Project. In this episode, we're going to discuss what makes a good story, what the elements of a good story are. As guests today, we have Mr. C, or Chris Jones. He's a wonderful past mentor of mine, and he is also a wonderful author, and we're very lucky to have him on today. We also have Paradigm's own Miss Latin, who's a wonderful mentor who's taught here for many years. All right, would you guys like to tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Sure, I'll go first. I'm Mr. C, also known as Brother C, also known in various places as Chris Jones, although I hardly respond to that anymore. I've been teaching for full-time as a pro for the last 6 years, I think. I started teaching maybe 10 years ago after extensive time in other fields that I hated more or less with every fiber of my being, and then only because I never, ever wanted to be a teacher did it take me as long as it did to end up doing that. You were in one of my first classes.
Yeah.
It was kind of fun.
It's a good
time.
To
catch up every 6 months or so when I come to Paradigm to substitute, or sometimes just to hang around the hallways and see if I can get in trouble. I also write books. I teach school, and I write, as what I tell people. I am a professor of writing, logic, and rhetoric at Mount Liberty College, which is right here in Salt Lake Valley. I've been there for 3 years. It's my fourth year. I teach freshmen. I teach writing, speaking, and defense against the dark arts, which is actually how it is listed in the college catalog. So that's my favorite class to teach. I teach that one every year. And I teach at a couple of other schools as well, including up in Idaho to a random group of ragamuffins who show up every now and then to take a class from me. I also write books. I write fiction, nonfiction. I write crime novels. I write pseudo-alternative history, murder mysteries in which the protagonist is actually a serial killer. Man, what else? I ghostwrite as well. Most of my writing income comes from ghostwriting, so I'm used to aping other people's styles as well. So I'm really excited to talk about story. So it's a big part of my life, whether I'm teaching or whether I'm writing.
Awesome. And Miss Latin?
So I've been teaching probably 30 plus years off and on, pretty much every level except below fifth grade, so up to college level. And I enjoy teaching writing and English and creative writing. I don't know, what else do you want to know?
And we're cousins.
And we're cousins,
we're,
yes,
actually first cousins, yeah. So so I get up here periodically when she wants a break. She gives me a call and I
you
come
do.
Up and teach. I love doing that. I love Paradigm.
And we're very glad about that. I am curious. So I know both of you are huge book nerds and you love literature. What would you say would be the time that appreciation of literature first started to grow within you?
That is a great question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. I'm trying to remember when it dawned on me that reading was one of the three or four most fun things that I could possibly do after breathing and eating. Young. Really young. I remember my father reading the Chronicles of Narnia to me, and I remember him, just how much he loved those books. And he had books everywhere. There were books all over the house, most of which I was forbidden to read, being, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. And I remember the first few books that I tried. I tried The Hobbit, one of the very first books I tried, I think. I remember loving Dr. Seuss. I remember, you know, all the books that you grow up with. You know, I don't know if I could put my finger on the moment where I was saying to myself, this is magic. What's happening here is outside the normal human experience. Something is happening to me that doesn't necessarily happen to other people. And somebody made that happen by putting these words on the page. I don't know, maybe Ender's Game when I was in junior high. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to think about that.
And I think with me, it's probably that I can remember first, second grade, my mom used to walk us over to the library that was just half a block away, and we'd bring back a big box of books. Just my whole family just always read, right?
Yeah.
All of our family,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, clearly it's like a hereditary thing or something, you know?
My mother is her father's sister, so they grew up in a house where literature, music, especially music, grandpa's vast, rather record collection. But there were books everywhere in that house, too. I didn't really realize that. But they just leave them around and expect that you would pick them up and just start reading it. And so, of course, we did.
And our grandparents both wrote a lot, too.
True. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I forget that Con was an author. Yeah. Our grandfather was an author and wrote a couple of books. And grandma's a reader. She's always reading something. There's always a book on her nightstand. So I guess it's just sort of in the water. You know, it's in the culture. We grew up with the idea that there was something about these collections of words that one day the mystery would be revealed to us and we would be let in on the secret. And so, of course, as little kids, you want that to happen immediately if you can.
But your grandmother, Jones, I can remember as a young kid, my mom saying, we need to have a dinner where we're there when she's telling stories, because she was really well known for her storytelling. And I think I got to sit in on one session that I can remember.
Yeah, they had no books. She grew up very, very poor in Blandon, and they had no books at all. So their entertainment was that my grandmother had a prodigious memory. She could memorize anything. And so she would remember these long stories. She'd memorize stories that went on for 15 or 20 minutes and memorize the whole thing. And then she would give what are called dramatic readings. If you, if you're familiar with Anne of Green Gables, another one of the very first ones that I just fell in love with. I've had a crush on Anne all my life, I think. She would stand up and give a reading, essentially tell a story. We call this cowboy poetry now, and we do stuff like that, fancy names for it. But she'd do a dramatic reading, and so it was not just telling the story, but she would do all the voices, all the names and stuff like that. And we grew up with this. We heard it all the time. She would send us audio tape recordings. My father would do a few of those, and he would play the guitar along with, or the ukulele along with the stuff. And it just, it was a really blurred line between music and literature and performance and reading, and all of it sort of blended together. And I mean, the word I keep using for that is magic, but it was a spell, and it was better than anything. And you could not grow up in those houses without being affected by it.
That's amazing. We actually did an episode fairly recently, and this is part of like kind of a loose series about the subject of storytelling, but we did one that's about like storytelling and music. And we talked very briefly about how those two things converge. And so it's interesting to hear about that in a context like this, which I don't believe we talked about. That's very interesting. I think it's super interesting to see where arts converge.
I have a question, if that's okay. So do you guys think that if you hadn't been raised with the love for storytelling that your family gave you, do you think that you would have had the same passion for it that you do now?
I would say yes, just because I love words. And those can be independent, obviously, of storytelling. But yeah, I just think I have an affinity towards stories.
Yeah, you're kind of asking us to imagine a universe in which down is up and up is down. Like, I don't know if I have that great of an imagination. Although, I guess we kind of can. My brother came to reading really late. He reads a lot now. But when he was a kid, the whole time we were growing up, I mean, he'd rather have been dipped in acid than pick up a book. I mean, he had no interest whatsoever. Probably at least partly because of his snotty older brother, who just read everything. I consumed millions of words and took pride in it. I mean, I liked it. And so I always had a book, and I'm sure that I was annoying about it. And so he refused to do any kind of reading. So some of that I think you bring with you. Anne of Green Gables. Anne Shirley grows up without, at least to a certain age, when she gets to be 12, 13 years old, and she's in an orphanage and doesn't really have access to that stuff, but she remembers the stories that she was told. Stories are everywhere, is the thing. They're not just in books, they're all over the place. And if you don't get them out of a book, you can make them up. One of my very earliest memories, as a matter of fact, is playing with Jennifer in the backyard of our grandparents' place. And we were playing, I don't know, some fairy tale or something. We did that all the time because we knew fairy tales and we knew the milieu of the genre, like how does a fairy tale work? And so we would start from Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or something like that. And then we would riff off for hours out there making up stories and adventures and things that were going on. And I think it was just the two of us. There had to be more kids around because we had more kids everywhere. But I only remember her and the swing set and the bottom of a very gentle hill that you could roll down. And I remember our space down there by the swing side under the green grass and the shade of the apricot tree. And I remember, you know, playing stories because that was what we both wanted to do. And I think that's irrepressible. I don't think, to answer your question, Winter, I don't know. I think we brought it with us when we came here, at least to a certain extent.
Because my youngest brother is dyslexic, and same thing. Took him a really long time to enjoy reading, but he reads quite a bit now. So, one early memory I have, too, is of Chris's dad, my Uncle Gordon. They lived in D.C., and we lived in Salt Lake City, and he would come for visits every few months, it seemed like a couple times a year. And so he was over at dinner at Grandma's, and he asked me what my favorite book was. And at the time, it was A Little Princess, Frances Hodgson Burnett, right? And I loved that book. And so I didn't see him for maybe six more months, and he came back, and he had found a copy of it at a used bookstore for me. And just, you know, and I think that solidified, like, this is what we do. This is, we give books, and we talk about books, and, you know, we exchange stories. And
he was forever doing that.
Yeah.
Forever going to used bookstores and estate sales, and he was never happier than in a giant warehouse full of used books, just going through and putting them in a box for a nickel a piece or whatever. And I used to go and just the smell of it. Like, it was a whole experience. It wasn't just what was in the book. It was the physical book itself was a thing. And it's one of the most magical times of my life.
I really like that sentiment that, like, it's beautiful what books are, because it really is just giving other people your thoughts in the physical form.
I mean, the whole idea of this podcast is like engaging in the great conversation of ideas. And books are probably one of the most long-lived and powerful forms of that.
Sure.
When you think about it, giving someone a book is like giving someone a part of yourself. It's so intimate to like share those thoughts and ideas in a permanent form that you can't get rid of. Like, I mean, the Library of Alexandria, this is very off topic, but
it's too soon. It's too soon to bring that up.
It'll always be
Some
too
of us
soon.
Are still in physical pain.
But even though the library is gone, we still hear about it. We can still hear stories about it and of how amazing it was. And it just comes to show that stories never really die.
And our imaginations are still here to like think about it and speculate about what it would have been like to invent more stories about that time. Stories just, it's the gift that keeps on giving. On kind of a similar note to like that first question about what your first moment of loving books would be, what do you think your greatest literary influence would be, whether it's a book or an author or a series? What would you say that would be?
That's
you actually
hard.
Forewarned us about this, yes. This exact question, and both of us looked at each other like,
that means making a choice. Come on.
Only had a day. I've been asked this question. I get asked this question a lot. People read my books and they're like, your books sound like so-and-so, or they sound like so-and-so, which... I mean, it's insane to start with. I mean, it's not true, but it sure is fun to have somebody say, you write just like Ray Bradbury. And I'm like, no, honestly, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But thank you so much. This is sort of like telling someone that they paint like Rembrandt. What do you do with that? But I have a few that I would say. And the first one that I always say is Orson Scott Card. I learned to write dialogue from reading Card. I think I've read everything he's ever published, including all of his essays, newsletters, every word of his that I could find. Ender's Game was one of the formative experiences in my teenage life, and I can say without hesitation that Speaker for the Dead changed the path of my life more than almost anything I've ever read other than, say, the scriptures. That book bent the path of my life toward teaching, toward working with young people, toward trying to understand other minds. Speaker for the Dead was cathartic. It was a revelation, that book, that you could maybe crawl into the head of another person for just a minute. And what would happen if you did that? And what would you understand? And how would you see the world differently? Because you would never be the same again. Teaching is very much like that,
yeah.
I think. To be a good teacher requires you to do that, to try to see the world from the point of view of a student. Bradbury, I hated Bradbury for a really long time because he was too good of a writer for me. And then, I don't know, it's 4 or 5 years ago, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try Bradbury. But instead of trying something easy, you know, one of his short stories, he wrote a lot of science fiction short stories. They're really interesting and fun to read. I thought, I'm going to try something a little more challenging. I'm going to try Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Ah.
That is the creepiest book I have ever read. That book, the hairs on my arm are standing up right now. That book still creeps me out. It's 5-6 years later. Bradbury's poetry, the way he crafts a sentence, the ridiculous smash up of words. It's like he doesn't care what words are supposed to be. He'll stuff them together in ways they've never been put together before, and somehow they work. And it drives me nuts because I can't do it. But I love to read some Bradbury before I start to write certain kinds of things, just because I know that that's going to infect the tone of what I write. Shakespeare, some of it, not all of it. The Apostle Paul. I love reading his, when I write nonfiction, I try to read Romans before I do it because he's so clearly logical and so definite about the things that he's trying to say. Sheesh. And then we could go on forever. St. Jane of Austen, L.M. Montgomery. And even writers that nobody pays attention to, really. Walter Farley wrote a huge series of Black Stallion novels. They're bad. But I loved them. I loved them. I still love them. I even go back and read them knowing that they're not good, because I loved them so much as a teenager. And that got me into Dick Francis novels. I read 30 Dick Francis crime novels. The first novel I ever actually finished was written almost as a copy of one of Dick Francis's novels. It was absolutely execrable. It's a horrible story. I have a copy on my shelf, but no one's allowed to read it. But then also movies too. Star Wars was gigantic for us.
Huge.
I think you have to mention that. We were post the Star Trek. Well, it wasn't really a phenomenon yet.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a poorly done, cheesy science fiction series. It was really more like a Western in space. And it kind of died off before we really got cranked up. But then Star Wars came along. And I bet you can remember seeing that movie the first time.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know I can. And that was really when movies started to really explode as a means of exploring creativity rather than we have a finished package. But the movies then, we started to have series. We started to have, you could explore characters in a much richer way. And I think that also really contributed. I have to mention Harry Potter. Have to. She didn't write those books for me, but... I will be forever grateful for Jo Rowling and what she did with those books. She invented the young adult genre, which is now one of the hottest selling fiction categories in fiction. I could go on forever, but you know, I'm sure Jennifer's got her own stack of 10 feet thick of books.
We've got some duplicates for
sure. Oh, yeah. Well, we really are kindred spirits. So.
Yeah, Narnia, for sure. I think that was the first series that I really remember affecting me. And I loved the order they were written in, which has been played with new publishers, which I hate because it gives you the history up front instead of, as a surprise, how it was written originally. And then...
Okay, so my question...
Yeah,
Warren
ruins it.
Okay, can I ask questions?
Definitely.
Okay, because I want to know. I'm always curious for Narnia fans. Do you prefer order as written or order in universe chronology?
Order as written.
Order as written.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you start with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, because it's so fantastic when you get to The Magician's Nephew and all this is revealed. And if it's reversed, it just takes all that away. So, yeah. So I object to that. I love Harry Potter, too, which I read as an adult. Great. Great series. Way to keep kids engaged, and even adults, right? Speaker for the Dead, I didn't read until I came to Paradigm. Yeah, it's a life-changing book, for sure. Makes you think so much about so many different things. Les Mis, which I read coming to Paradigm. And then I do like short story authors, more modern ones, probably Alice Munro. She's Canadian. She's really great. And then I also love Isabel Allende. She's from Chile. She's written some amazing books and a lot of historical fiction, but just that really pull you in. The stories are very compelling.
So you guys briefly touched on Star Wars, and I wanted to ask, is there anywhere that you think movies fail in storytelling that books excel in or vice versa?
I think movies have gotten better at not recreating new endings and going completely off script. But I don't know. I don't think there's ever a movie that really is superior to a book.
Oh, no, that's not true.
Okay,
no, there
give me
are,
one.
There are movies that are better than the books.
Oh.
It's a short list.
Okay.
I admit it's short. But there is a list. For me, Scarlet Pimpernel is one of those. I hate Baroness Orsay's writing. I just don't like it. It doesn't work for me. Now, that's not her fault. And I will say several times, I'm sure, during the course of this podcast, I don't like that book. That book's terrible, whatever. What I mean is, whatever that author did doesn't work for me. But I'm really sure that the Baroness Orsay could not care less what I think about her book. So I recognize it as a personal character defect, not as something that's wrong right. with the book. Does that make sense? But I thought Scarlet Pimpernel, which was not actually made for the big screen first. Oh, no, it was. The first one was starring, what is his name? He's in Gone with the Wind.
Clark Gable?
Not him. He plays... the other guy.
Ashley.
He is the Scarlet Pimpernel in the original. It's an old black and white film, and it is spectacular. It's so good. He is utterly brilliant in that film. And I thought that was better than the book. I read the book. I was really disappointed. The reverse is true with Scaramouche, which is a similar story about a dude who saves the good people of the French Revolution or whatever by Raphael Sabatini. Scaramouche is a terrific book. The movie is a disaster, so no. But then really, it's a short list. I didn't actually figure out why that was. You know, as a kid, I'm like, this is stupid. Why don't they just make the movie like the book? How hard is this? It's right there in print. Can you not read? I read it. So how can you not read this book? But yes, you can. The thing is, the book is 375 pages long. The movie script is 165 double-spaced pages. You just can't. One page of movie script, and I've written some scripts as well. One page of movie script is about 1 minute of film. And you don't want to go more than about 120 minutes. So, and that this also depends on what kind of a movie you're talking about. If you're talking about Psycho, the script for Psycho is like 62 pages long. The movie's an hour and a half because there are 10, 12-minute sections of Psycho in which no one says anything. This is why Hitchcock is so awesome, because he can get away with that. Everybody else, you're like, what? Right. I can't remember. Somebody told me that the shortest script in the last 20, 30 years is Castaway.
Interesting.
Because Tom Hanks is by himself on an island for 45 minutes of the middle of the film, and there is a volleyball to talk to who doesn't have a lot of lines. So that's a very short script and lots of description. So the thing is, you can't do it. You really cannot put all of the stuff that's in a book. The closest attempt that I can think of is Peter Jackson doing Lord of the Rings, where he just decided, I'm going to shoot as many hours of film as I need in order to tell the story that I want to tell. And even then, he doesn't get all of it done as farce in the Hobbit movies, which then take 114 hours to tell a book that you could probably do in 3 hours, and adding all sorts of fascinating apocryphal garbage to the canon. But there are a few, but there really aren't many. And those books tend to be sort of different sorts of books. It's very hard to do a standard literary book. It's really hard to do Anne of Green Gables. That's why they don't do it as a movie. They do it as a long series when you can actually, you know, give appropriate time to it. But I think it's just alterations of medium. When Star Wars was originally just a screenplay and then got written as a book, and I read that book several times, and there was all kinds of stuff in it that was not in the movie. And I'm like, well, this is fascinating. Look, we created all this other cool stuff. But then, you know, as an adult, I'm looking back and saying, oh, yeah, well, they had 200 extra pages to fill in. So they made up a bunch of stuff that wasn't in the movie. But then you're creating reality. Like, you got to be careful with something like that, because the movie is canon, but then you write a book that is the book of the movie, but there's way more stuff in it. So then which is real is that gets into a whole nother thing. Like, which part of that is real? Realize that we're talking about a completely fictional franchise. which part of is the real fiction, and which is the fictional fiction? And there are ongoing knife fights on the internet right now as to those to answer those questions.
Star Wars has a very heated fandom.
Well, I think we've talked about this, Chris and I, before when he's come to visit, that television and especially streaming, right, where you can binge watch a whole series and movies, I think they really do influence modern writing. I don't think you can escape that. And maybe even created a different type of reader, too, that's expecting more action.
Mm. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. I actually think that's probably true. Certainly, when you sit down to read Les Misérables, or you sit down to read Bleak House, or you sit down to read even Pride and Prejudice, which has one of the greatest opening lines in all of literature, it's a slow burn. And modern readers don't trust you that much. There are some authors that can get away with that kind of thing still, I think. By this point, Brandon Sanderson is probably one of those guys.
Absolutely.
You trust him enough, and he's got, it's going to be 1,200 pages. So settle in, you know, get comfortable. Make sure you have a big glass of water because it's going to take a minute to get through. And so I think he gets some latitude that way but he's earned it and he's asked for it by the way that he writes. For a lot of other authors, or lesser authors like myself, we really have to get right to it in order to get the reader to trust us enough to stay with us for 300 pages.
I'd like to touch on that as well, because, you know, with new forms of media coming out and with technology advancing every day, we now have different forms of storytelling like YouTube or TikTok, where a story can take as low as a minute. You know, we get so used to just in and out, just bam, bam, bam. We know all the information now that we lose the patience and just the true savoring that comes when you experience a really, truly great story.
Great word, yeah. You do savor
the savoring. It's a really good word. Yeah, I think you do a little. I am, in one breath, a hardcore traditionalist. My house is just awash in books. I love the physical books. I love them. I also have 2,600 books on Kindle. And I read those obsessively. And so in one breath, I think that the physical book, I think every book I write, I will actually have a physical book. I don't think I'm ever going to write exclusively an ebook. Don't ever say never, but I don't think I'm going to, because I like the physical copy. I like to hold it in my hand. There's something about the physicality. We talked about that a little bit a few minutes ago. The physicality of the book is part of the experience. And the pace that you have to take the book at, something I didn't pay attention to until fairly recently, but the actual physical copy of the book slows you down. You have to consume it at a particular pace. With audiobooks, you don't have to do that. You can dial it up as fast as you want. Some of my students consume audiobooks at 3 times speed or 3.5 times speed, and to me, it sounds like Alvin and the Chipmunks. Like, I can't make anything out of it. But for them, it works because they've learned to process at that speed. I haven't learned to do that. But I also like that the author is forcing me to take this book at a certain pace. And yet, I love radio plays. I love podcasts. I love alternate form storytelling. I like YouTube storytelling. God, just got to be 6 or 7 years ago, I had an idea where I was going to do an entire set of short stories entirely in text. So you would get them, you'd sign up, and you would get them throughout the day. Every couple of hours, you'd get another 140 characters. And I wrote a couple of short stories exclusively in 140 character chunks so that they could work for that. As it turns out, that's not how texting works. So the story thing worked well, but the technology didn't. But I loved kind of playing around with, when you're restricted to 140 characters in a sentence, it really changes the nature of the story that you can tell and the way that you have to tell it, which is so much fun to play with. I love flash fiction. I write micro flash. I write flash fiction. I like really short stories to see, can you cut it down to its essence and still get it to work? Because it's so hard to do that. But I also like novels where you get, you can spend 48 pages talking about the Paris sewer system. Assuming you know 48 pages worth of information about Mr. Hugo, which he does apparently. Yep.
Definitely. Victor Hugo was quite the sewer expert. I do have a question on the subject of alternative methods of storytelling. Do good stories necessarily have to be linear with a structure of like exposition in, or an intro, rising action, climax, falling action, then to resolution? Is that an absolutely necessary part
of a story? Absolutely not. We wouldn't even have the modern novel or modern short stories if that were true. So,
what are some good examples of books that don't follow that structure?
Well, I'm thinking mainly of short stories, but Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, there's a lot more internal monologue. There's a lot more internal landscape. Usually the climax is right at the end, almost like an epiphany. Yeah, that's very, very, very prolific. So, yeah.
It's hard, though. This is a Western convention. Eastern literature and even in South American stuff. Gabriel Garcia Marquez does not write that way, really. Chana Miaville does not write that way. Those books are very hard for me. But I recognize the beauty of the language that is sort of in juxtaposition with the brutality of the story. Miaville's really hard for me to read. The best example that I always use happens to be a movie, but Spirited Away is one of my favorites on that. I love Miyazaki films so much. And one of the reasons people really struggle with Spirited Away and a couple of other Miyazaki's films is they're not necessarily linear. They don't make sense in the same sort of story arc way that that you would expect and that Western audiences sort of impose on their narrative experience. I don't know. I've thought a lot about this question, actually. There's a movie, trying to remember the name of it now, but it's shot in reverse. It's a sort of a murder mystery type thing with a guy who has short-term memory loss and can't remember things that happened more than a few seconds ago. And so they shot the entire film backward, starting at the end and going all the way to the beginning. It was one of the most gripping and weird films I'd ever seen. But there's a lot of that in that. Arthur C. Clarke, even, 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is a very different book than the movie, but both of them are quite good. There are chunks of it that just don't seem to fit the way you would expect things to work. And I don't know that Clark could get away with it now, but he certainly did at the time. That said, I have to tell my stories in a particular way. I don't have to write them that way, but I do have to tell them that way. Because it never, although I can follow another kind of story and I can even have a tremendous amount of appreciation for it, it's sort of like hearing something in a foreign language that you speak really well. You get it, you understand the story, but it never has quite the same emotional richness than it would in your native language. Similar sort of a thing. I grew up with the standard, this is how a story works idea from every story that, you know, that I grew up with. And so that's really the milieu that I swim in. That's really the method that it feels right to me. This is what a story should feel like, should do. You can get outside that, make it work. But it, for me, it's never quite like home.
I like, the classical storytelling form, but I also love to experiment and I love to see new ways of approaching a story.
Yeah. And as you guys have talked about this, it's reminding me of so many different ways of storytelling that I've seen. Whether it be in like film or book or even like musical form. A really interesting example I thought of is there's this musical that is also a movie that stars Jeremy Jordan and Anna Kendrick called The Last 5 Years. And it's actually told, it goes from that linear like beginning to end, and it also does end to beginning at the same time. It's told from the perspective of two different characters, and it goes between flashbacks. It's a very interesting way of storytelling. But it is also like a little bit jarring. I can kind of see what you were saying, Mr. C, about how it's a little bit like a foreign language.
I don't know if you guys have heard of this movie, but there is this movie called 500 Days of Summer. And it's this romance movie between our main character who works this office job. And one day there's a new lady that comes in and her name is Summer. And she compliments his music taste. And it's just a very original and, like, genuine meeting. And throughout the movie, you can see this little stamp of three numbers, and it changes, and it goes back and forth. So the first scene, it'll be like 001, day one of summer. And then it'll go to 364 or 271, and it's just that back and forth. And throughout the movie, you see these little tidbits where they're perfectly in love to absolutely hating each other from one second to the next. And it feels like this insane whiplash, but in reality, there's supposed to be these periods, long periods of time between these events that you're seeing. It's just that... That mastering of time and compelling your audience to put the storyline together by themselves that I think really cemented my love for that movie.
Yeah, I think it's worth doing that. I think it's worth challenging ourselves in that way. Different cultures have different relationships with time. We're used to the idea of rule by the clock. Everybody has a clock. If there's anything we use our phones for more than texting or whatever, it's to check the time. We use them like watches. And down to the minute is a big deal. You're ruled by a bell schedule at class. You know, hardly anybody gets together for dinner somewhere between 7 and 9. But that was the normal thing in all of human history until railroads, railroads made it so that we had to have standard set of timepieces. Otherwise, you smash very heavy iron things into each other, which is unpleasant for the people who are on board. Until then, really, who cared what time it was in Pittsburgh? Unless you lived in Pittsburgh, why did you care? You can't talk to anyone there. You can't get there. And when you do, whatever time it is there, that's whatever time it is. We had non-standard time in the United States up until the middle of the 1800s, and some places even later, and it didn't make any difference, and no one cared. Noon was whenever you wanted it to be. When you were going to eat, or then, you know, you regulated much more by the sun, which is a very imprecise measurement in terms of do you have mountains or in a valley or those kinds of things. And other cultures, even to an even greater degree, African societies have very non-linear concepts of time, very circular concepts of time, which are very hard for me to wrap my head around. I really struggle with that. The Chinese, especially, but many Asian cultures, have a much different view of time. One of my favorite stories on that, I have to tell the story every time I get an opportunity because it's so awesome. So a Chinese ambassador came to the United States, and one of the reporters was, I guess it was a kind of a gotcha thing where he wanted to, you know, to kind of annoy the guy. And so he says, this is just a few years ago. So he says, Mr. Ambassador, what do you think of the United States policy in World War II? And the ambassador took a moment in that inscrutable Chinese way. And after a second or two, he said, I think it's too soon to tell. And everybody laughs, ha, ha, ha. But if you're Chinese and the concept of 500 years is, you know, that's a normal time frame for making plans, it's too soon to tell. It's only been 70, 80 years. I mean, who knows? Do we do the right thing or not? We're used to the instant news cycle. Like we pass judgment on what somebody did within the first 45 or 50 seconds of them doing it. One of the rules I set myself after I spent a bunch of time reading African literature and reading some Asian literature as well is that I never comment on anything in public ever on any event for 72 hours after it happens, because inevitably I'm going to say something incredibly stupid because we're still sorting it out. I mean, the debris hasn't even fallen to the ground yet, and we're already deciding who's at fault for 9/11. I think it's an error, and I think that our relationship with time that way can, I think it's fun to play with that in stories as well. Fundamentally, I actually think that time is not our natural milieu. I think that humans are not meant to be in time. That it feels weird. That's why it rockets by in times when you want it to go really slow, and it crawls when you're in math class. Other unpleasant situations, not at all like math class. Sorry, my wife's a math teacher, so I make math jokes all the time. But you're all familiar with that. I mean, you know that. Let me tell you that changes, that the elasticity of time also vastly, vastly changes as you get older. We have a very different relationship with time than you do, which allows us a lot of times to be much more patient. And so we seem wise because everybody's reacting to what's happening in the hallway right now or during lunch or whatever. And we're like, you know, there's going to be a hallway and lunch tomorrow too. But for you guys, that's an appreciable fraction of your lifetime. For us, it's, you know. And if your culture is many thousands of years older, like the Chinese or the Egyptians, think what that does to the present moment is not even relevant. It doesn't actually matter at all. So their storytelling also sort of reflects that.
Yeah. As an example, when I was looking into like literary examples of different kinds of storytelling, there's a piece of Indian scripture called, and I'm totally going to mess up the pronunciation, but the Mahabharata or something like that. And that's told in a very non-linear way where it's basically a series of flashbacks throughout the entire book. But it offers some interesting insight into that culture's way of looking at time. I think it's interesting to talk about how while time itself is like unchanging and unstoppable, our perception of it changes constantly. And it's also interesting to see how authors do that, how they can make time go so slowly. It happens across really like all different forms of media, I think, all different ways of storytelling, of art, where like in movies, we have like slow-mo action scenes where all of a sudden we're seeing the film in a very different way. In books, I mean, we'll have brief descriptions of long stretches of time, or we'll have very in-depth exploration of these tiny, tiny moments in time. Time is, I mean, it's an essential part of a story. And the way it interacts with the story can change entirely the meaning of the story. Anyways, that was a little tangent.
That was a good question.
So we've reached the end of our time together. There is something that we do at the end of our episodes usually. We have a challenge and a takeaway. Is there a specific one that either of you would like to do?
I always have. You mean a challenge delivered by us to whoever's listening to this podcast?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I got one. Write something. Write something. I don't care if it's a journal, I don't care if it's a poem, I don't care if it's song lyrics or a short story or like a whole novel. Write something. But that's not the challenge, because we write stuff all the time. We do it with our phones, we do it on paper. If you're in school, I imagine the majority of people listening to this will be in school of one type or another. That's not the challenge, because you write all the time. Here's the challenge. You have to show it to somebody. You have to write it, and then you have to show it to somebody. That's what we call publishing. Winter actually almost went down one of my very favorite little side roads in this, when she started talking about how you put it on paper, and it's a bit of your soul, and I'm over here going, oh, you have no idea how impossibly hard that is, because you lose control of it. The way people read your story is not the way you wrote it. So it's a participatory experience. I'm making a contribution, but so are you. And I don't have any control over what you do. And it drives me up a freaking wall, because you might not like what I did. And if I've poured so much of my soul into it, what does that do to me? And it's excruciating. It's why most writers don't publish. And that is true. The vast majority of writers do not publish anything. They really just can't stand the idea that they don't have control over. And you see that with Rowling, with a lot of other people who are trying to control their universe once it gets out there. I'm sorry, it's a fool's errand. You can't do it. So you have to publish. That's the difference between writers and authors. Writers write. Authors publish. So publish it. Show it. Share it. Show it to someone else. Give it away. It hurts like crazy. But you have to do it. Back to Narnia. You got to row your little coracle to the ever-breaking wave and up and over to the other side. Because if you don't, you will never know what is there. You cannot know any other way. You can't see through it. You can't visit. You got to go to that land. Well, you got to go. So that's my challenge. Write something, whatever it is, and show it to someone else. Share it. Give it away. Give them a chance to respond to you with that. That's my challenge.
That's a wonderful challenge.
My takeaway would be everyone has a story. It's very important to always acknowledge that and listen for the stories, because it is a part of your soul. It's what makes us unique. And the way you tell a story is also unique. So you always need to be aware of those stories. That's what makes a human more full, I think. It helps us to empathize and relate.
We are the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. We become the person that we tell ourselves we are. The story that you write in your head about what you do, that's the person that you actually are. And that's why those are so important and why they are so unique. Because no one else is you.
That challenge and takeaway are both intensely human. You can feel how powerful they are. So thank you. Okay, thank you all for listening to the... actually, do you want to do it? You do it.
Oh, sure. Okay. Thank you, everybody at home, for listening to this episode of The Paradigm Project. We hope you enjoyed all of the amazing things that us and our guests had to say today, and that you do try out the challenge for yourselves.
And keep engaging in the great conversation of ideas.